One of the hardest parts of getting older is feeling like something's off in your body, but not knowing exactly what. It's not just aging. It's often your hormones, too. When they fall out of balance, everything feels off. But here's the good news. This doesn't have to be the story of your next chapter. Hormone Harmony by Happy Mammoth is an herbal formula made with science-backed ingredients designed to fine-tune your hormones by balancing estrogen, testosterone, progesterone, and even stress hormones like cortisol. It helps with common issues such as hot flashes, poor sleep, low energy, bloating, and more. With over 40,000 reviews and a bottle sold every 24 seconds, the results speak for themselves. A survey found 86% of women lost weight, 77% saw an improved mood, and 100% felt like themselves again. Start your next chapter feeling balanced and in control. For a limited time, get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com with code NEXTCHAPTER at checkout. Visit happymammoth.com today and get your old self back naturally.
This podcast is sponsored by IQ Bar.
I've got good news and bad news. Here's the bad news. Most protein bars are packed with sugar and unpronounceable ingredients. The good news? There's a better option. I'm Will, and I created IQ Bar Plant Protein Bars to empower doers like you with clean, delicious, low-sugar brain and body fuel. IQ Bars are packed with 12 grams of protein, brain nutrients like magnesium and lion's mane, and zero weird stuff. And right now, you can get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Try our delicious IQ Bar sampler pack with 7 plant protein bars, 4 hydration mixes, and 4 enhanced coffee sticks. Clean ingredients, amazing taste, and you'll love how you feel. Refuel smarter, hydrate harder, caffeinate larger with IQ Bar.
Go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20 to get 20% off all IQ Bar products, plus free shipping. Again, go to eatiqbar.com and enter code BAR20.
Tired of trying diet after diet without results? Mochi Health offers a long-term weight loss solution personalized to your needs. Our board-certified obesity doctors and registered dietitians provide expert guidance to help you succeed. Eligible patients can access custom-formulated GLP-1 medication at an affordable set price delivered monthly. Take our free quiz at joinmochi.com and use code AUDIO40 for $40 off your first month. That's joinmochi.com.
Welcome to Queer Storytime, the podcast. This is a brave space for sharing queer and trans stories of radical affirmation, acceptance, empowerment, and healing. I'm your host, Stevie Ingram. I so look forward to you joining us. If you haven't done so already, please be sure to subscribe to this podcast. Alrighty, y'all, queer in 3, 2, 1. Let's go.
Transgender children, shock, awe, horror. This is what we'll be discussing today on episode 13 of QST with a transgender author who wrote a book on this topic. Before getting into today's episode, we're going to practice a short guided meditation together. This will be especially useful for those listening who may already be having some negative reactions given the subject that we're about to discuss today. As usual, I invite each one of you into a comfortable seated position. You may have the eyes open or closed. And I invite each one of you into awareness of breath, moving your awareness from the outer environment to the inner environment of the mind and the body. Notice how you're showing up to this episode. Notice if you're arriving about particular thoughts, beliefs, conditionings, anger, rage, frustration. Or you might be arriving here with excitement. Just noticing what is arising for you in the moment. holding whatever is arising in a gentle space of awareness. Notice where you feel excitement in the body. Notice where you feel anger in the body. Almost as if you're a scientist looking through the lens of a microscope. In that same way, you're using your inner awareness to look through the lens of your inner landscape. Just observing. Notice that you might be reacting to how it is you're feeling. Noticing that we create a story, or that we easily create a story on top of feelings and emotions that arise. Moving from that space of reactivity into simply a place of observation. Breathing through any strong sensations, deeply inhaling, deeply exhaling. Then, as you're ready, gently begin opening the eyes and welcoming you back into the room that surrounds you. Now introducing today's guest, Ben Green, whose pronouns are he, him. Ben is an international public speaker, transgender man, and author of the book, My Child is Trans, Now What? He lives in St. Louis, Missouri, and is a passionate advocate for transgender youth. He strives to meet everyone with compassion, no matter where they're starting from. Welcome, Ben, to Queer Storytime. I'm so excited to have you here to talk about your life journey and the book that you've written. So why don't you start out by telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for having me. I'm so stoked to be here. Let's see a little bit about myself. I'm Ben Green. I use he, him pronouns. I am an international public speaker, a transgender man who came out about a decade ago, a public speaker, an advocate for transgender young people. I live in St. Louis, Missouri, and so I am very involved in politics, largely against my will, but it turns out that I'm pretty good at it. And I'm also a huge nerd because I'm a firm believer that we are so much more than just our identities and our labels. I'm not a whole lot more than nerd. Most things end up falling into that category. I love science fiction and fantasy and video games and Dungeons and Dragons and all that good stuff. And I just love helping meet allies wherever they are. I focus a lot on joy and on non-judgment and education. And it has been a really cool journey that I've been on, and so exciting that this book that I came up with 6 years ago is actually out in the world now and people are reading it on purpose.
That is so amazing. So for you, maybe we'll start at the beginning of your journey, maybe even prior to you transitioning. Do you want to talk a little bit about that time in your life prior to transitioning? Yeah, how was life around that time?
Yeah, I used to start that story at around the age of puberty. And I used to say, well, that was when I started to really know something was different about me. And before then, I just identified it as weird. I knew I wasn't good at being a girl, and I thought it was because of being a person. But then a couple of weeks ago, I went to visit my family for the weekend, and they're getting ready to move out of their house. And so I was going through some of the papers in my bedroom, and I found a letter I had written to myself in third grade in health class. We had to write a letter to be given to ourselves at graduation. And the very beginning of the letter said, "Let's get one thing straight. You will never like pink. you will never wear a dress. Don't be a girl. And I saw that, and honestly, it kind of broke my heart to wonder how many other times had I tried to articulate who I was and how I felt in ways that people hadn't known enough to know how to look for. What was the life that I could have led if it had been known that people can be transgender? If my parents or my teachers had noticed that I wrote down something that seemed very gender dysphoric and had said, hey, do you want some resources? Do you know that this is allowed? And so I definitely have been like processing through that. I have a very good therapist. I'm sure I've paid for like a lot of wonderful things in her house. So that was the very beginning. And I'm still kind of figuring out all the time, finding these little Easter eggs of transness in what I think are normal childhood memories. But I think the story that I'm really feels the most explicitly queer was first that I was questioning my sexuality, which felt a lot more familiar because I had the language to describe a crush. And I just knew that it was pointed at girls and not at boys. And I tried to be so normal about talking to my friends about that. I pulled all of my other female friends and I was like, hey, on a scale from 1 to 10, how beautiful do you think women are? That was how I asked that question. I thought that I was so slick. Let me tell you, straight people don't answer a 9. They're not passing much more of like a 3 or a 4 or like, yes, my friends are so pretty. All the boys should date them. And I'm like, well, no, that's not really what I'm asking. So I came out as bisexual pretty soon after that because I was like, I'm not going about this in the way that other people are. And when I came out to a friend as bisexual, and I'm from small town Connecticut, one store, one stoplight, tiny town. And I came out to a friend and he said, that's really cool. There's actually a Facebook group for queer youth across the whole state of Connecticut that now that you've come out to me, I can add you to that. Do you want to be a part of it? And I said, yeah, that would be amazing because all of our towns are really small. So we didn't have particularly large queer communities in any one town. And so we formed a larger one together. This group had no adult involvement. It was a secret Facebook group. It was over 400 kids. It's honestly a miracle that it stayed so safe. As far as I know, no major disasters. And it was amazing. I joined this group and all of a sudden, people are coming out. We were having debates and meetups and I was finding people to date and to get to know. The best man from my wedding I met through that group. And so after a few months of being in that group, somebody posted and said, hey, I'm coming out as transgender and here's what that means. And this is the post I shared with my school. What do you all think? And I had this moment of like, whoa, holy shit. I did not know that was allowed because I had spent the last couple of months going through puberty and hating it, but not in the way what everybody says, oh, puberty's awful. Everybody hates puberty. I would look into the mirror and I just could not recognize the person looking back at me. I know that is like the biggest stereotypical trans movie ever is the mirror scene. And I would spend hours just crying because I was afraid. I now know the word is dissociating, but I would look in the mirror and feel like I just got like astral projected out of my body. And I didn't know what the solution was, what it meant. And so I saw this Facebook post that said, hey, I'm transgender. Here's what it means. And everything immediately was like, whoa, could that be me? And there was still definitely a lot of doubt around, well, I'm not masculine enough. I'm not the most manly person ever. I don't want to be a rugged man. Is that allowed? Can I be transgender? And so I still had to do a lot of research. I had the words to ask the questions. And that was everything. That was the final key to unlock the door. And so it was definitely a journey that took a lot longer than I think it could have if I had had access to education and visibility. But I'm really grateful, even at 15, that's still a lot younger than many, many people.
Yeah, I think you point to certainly what has been my experience and many other trans people's experiences. Like, we have language for sexuality before we do gender identity. What are your thoughts on that or why that may be?
Yeah, you know, I think it's just because it's familiar to people. Most people can identify the feeling of attraction, and so they can theoretically empathize with what it means to be attracted to another person. We have a baseline of understanding, but gender identity, and specifically gender identity existing different from, and not necessarily independent of, but as a different concept than biological sex, is something that most people have not considered. Because if they fit together so comfortably, you don't really notice that they're there, right? It's the same as I said, like, okay, you know, you're wearing a shirt that's too small. Okay, you know what that means. The soles of your shoes are not the exact right shape of the fit of your shoe. Most people are like, I couldn't imagine what it would feel like for the inlining of my shoe to not be the right shape. We're just so used to it being comfortable. And so gender identity, I think because more people are comfortable with it and because more work has gone in to erasing education around gender identity from our schools, the existence of trans people, erasing that from history, that's been an even larger effort to either wipe it away as just, you know, being gender deviant or being just a little bit gay. You know, people like Freddie Mercury and David Bowie, who were extremely gender nonconforming, that was written away as, all right, well, if they're going to do it, like, we're going to call it being kind of gay, you know, but we're not going to talk about gender deviance, because I think for a lot of people, that feels even less familiar, a lot scarier, more threatening to their way of life. So there's more of an intention to, like, make that education harder to access.
Right. Yeah. And we're seeing that all over the United States right now, in the UK, you know, all over the world, this eradication of queer and trans literature and education around diversity, equity, and inclusion. What are some salient points that you have in regards to the political movement to delegitimize queer and trans people, essentially?
Yeah, what I'd say, and what I think is so, so crucial for us all to hear, is that what we are seeing is a group of people, a small group of people, largely coming from a far right, either explicitly or implicitly Christian perspective that says, I am desperately holding on to the way I thought the world was, to the simplicity I thought was there, to the power I once had. This is the group that, to me, represents the final thing that will unseat my connection to power, my norms of what the world is supposed to look like. We are the final scissors cutting the thread of the way the world makes sense to them. So we're seeing a death cry. It is a reaction of absolute terror of a small group of individuals who are profoundly well-resourced, profoundly well-connected, profoundly secretive. A lot of us don't know about the Heritage Foundation, the Alliance Defending Freedom, you know, the few groups that are driving a lot of this work. I feel that it is a death cry, because the reality is we have had an extreme increase in visibility. More people than ever before are seeing trans characters on TV, have a gay neighbor, are seeing pride flags when they drive down the street. They're exposed to trans and queer identities, but we are not seeing a matching rise in education. So what that means is a lot of people who thought they understood how the world works are feeling ashamed, are feeling confused or overwhelmed or threatened, and there's not that education. So when folks who are saying, this is my enemy, bring in misinformation, bring in fear, misinformation and radicalization works because it's comforting. It says, I know you're afraid. We'll protect you. We understand who the bad guy is. We understand that you can't afford your rent. Here, it's the job of woke people that are taking that away from you. It's their fault. Here is your target. And there's a really wonderful book by Judith Butler that's called Who's Afraid of Gender that taps into a lot of the psychology here. That's amazing. But one of the things I really want to highlight is that it can be so easy to feel like everyone hates us, but most people are not hateful. They have a lot of big emotions. They're afraid. They're confused. They're ashamed. Maybe they have heard a lot of misinformation. Misinformation is a multi-billion dollar industry. It's a machine. It does not happen by accident. For many people, it does not happen by choice. So there is a small group of hateful people, but day-to-day people, when I travel to every corner of this country, again, I live in Missouri, people are not hateful. The other big thing I really want to point out, and the last kind of big point I make about this, is that we are not fighting a fight on the battleground of facts and logic. A lot of people talk to me about the bills that are being proposed, and they say, I just don't understand. It doesn't make any sense. The logic isn't there. Isn't there this study that disproves it? Isn't this not actually, you know, something? But that's not what it has ever been about. The trans athletics bills are a perfect example. In Missouri, we had 8 anti-trans sports bills proposed last year. We already have a rigorous process for someone to get approved to play sports of a different, you know, of their gender identity rather than their sex assigned at birth. So we know how many trans athletes we have, K through 12. It's 5. That's more than one bill per child. They could have just written a bill for each child by name, but that was never what it was about. What it was about was creating a narrative by bringing up this debate, the transgender question, the trans sports debate. Everybody who's hearing about it on the news assumes that we agree there's a problem and we disagree about the solution. And by addressing these bills at face value, we legitimize their points. They bring up totally bonkers. They know that there are not transgender athletes stealing every trophy from your child. They know that there are not examples of transgender people assaulting people in bathrooms, especially not as many as priests and youth pastors and police officers. But it's not about that. It is about painting a picture of a very scary group of people and of about building support for that erasure. For a lot of people, that has worked and created anger and hate. For a lot of people, it has also created confusion. They say, but I don't understand. What about sports? What about fairness? And I say fairness in women's sports is so important to me. That's why I advocate for equal pay for women's athletes to men's athletes. That's why I advocate for my sister in the NCAA to get just as cool of a workout room as the men's sports teams do. I talk about fairness in women's sports and I redirect what is an actual problem that we can agree on, rather than look at the flashy thing, look at me shaking my keys, transgender bathroom bills, that's not what it's about. And so trying to make sense of it and instead look a little deeper at what is the goal underlying these bills is so important as well.
Absolutely. And we see that through and through, that the intention is to invoke fear into people or to elicit their own fear response. Base this on any logic, facts, or science.
Yeah, it's meant to be very distracting and confusing, scary.
So, I mean, what would your message be for people that may have conflicts with their faith? They see this culture war happening and they're, you know, experiencing this tug in their heart kind of between, there may be this semblance of, I know this is wrong, but something else, some other worldview is telling me that this is right at the same time. How do you navigate that?
Yeah, and faith in particular is such an interesting one that I've been on a lot of different journeys with throughout my life. There is this view of LGBTQ identities and faith and religion as the opposite ends of a spectrum. You have to pick a side and you have to be somewhere in between. But the reality is that is not dichotomy at all. I became more religious after I came out because of the support that I received from my synagogue, from my rabbi. Now, Judaism is often known for being a very affirming religion, but I also know trans people of every denomination, of every religion, who are there and who have found support in their faith. There are a few things that I like to share about that.
Please.
The first thing that people often say about trans people, like, but God doesn't make mistakes. I want to support you, but how could you say that God has done something wrong? And there's a quote that I really love from a book called Something That May Shock and Discredit You. And the line is, God made me transgender for the same reason he made grapes instead of wine and wheat instead of bread, so that humanity could share in the divine magic of creation. I was not made trans by mistake. Yeah, I get to create myself. And that's really lovely.
Was that a Jewish rabbi or who said that?
No, that was just like an author writing a book of short stories. It was not written by a faith leader.
Oh, okay. Beautiful, nonetheless.
Yeah, I really think about that quote so frequently, and it really does feel very magical and spiritual to have gotten to have a hand in my own creation. It feels really cool.
Mm.
The other thing I love to say about faith in particular is that I'm not going to sit here and quote lines of scripture that say it's okay to be gay and say, here's the gotcha. Here's the moment where I can tell you, but you wear mixed fabrics, but you eat shellfish. Most people have heard that at this point. They're aware of the hypocrisy. The reality is, and this is my life philosophy for far beyond religion, you can find evidence of anything you're looking for. You can find evidence that your best friend is in love with you. You can find evidence that your best friend hates you. You can decide what you want to look for. And in religion, I think that is exceptionally true. If you want an excuse to be hateful, you can find a line in any religious text that tells you, yes, good, stoke the fire. That person is not right. If you want to find a reason to be loving, you can look to your religious text and find a line that says, be loving, love your neighbor, protect them. You can find queer characters in every major religious text that exists. You get to decide what to look for. Are you going to look for the sword or look for the shield? I can't make that choice for you, but really letting people know there is a choice. You are making the choice of which part of your text you want to focus on, because both are in there. What choice do you want to make? What are you looking for? And I think that's also a helpful context for, you know, how different people can approach it.
Definitely. I would love for you, if you don't mind, to talk about how you have navigated your Jewish faith. I believe, as far as I remember, that you're the first Jewish guest on the podcast. So, so take it away.
Yeah. And I actually know so many transgender people who transitioned and then converted to Judaism because it is such a there is so much queerness in the Torah and in Jewish mysticism. And that's really lovely. And so much of Judaism, and I have friends hear the term Judeo-Christian, and they assume, okay, Judaism is just Christian with Hanukkah or with Shabbat instead, you know, Friday service instead of Sunday service. Judaism is very, very different from Christianity. You all looked at our source material and did a very bad job. I don't know what your faith is. You all, to the Christians, did a bad job cheating off our test. That's what I'll say. Judaism, one of the biggest differences I find is that it is very much about survival, about joy, about taking care of ourselves and each other. One of the things that I really love about Judaism, and this isn't necessarily in relation to my queerness at first, but we have a lot of fasting holidays. And one of the big things about the fasting holidays, we have this idea of a mitzvah, which is a kind thing you can do to yourself, to others. There are so many different mitzvot or mitzvahs that you can contribute to the world around you. And so it is a mitzvah to fast on all of these fasting holidays. And if you are someone who is old, if you are sick, if you're someone with an eating disorder, if fasting in any way wouldn't be good for you, the mitzvah is to eat. Judaism never asks you to put yourself in harm's way, never says you must be sacrificing for your faith. You must hurt yourself, feel shame, feel guilt. We don't have sins. We don't have hell. We don't have things like that. Obviously, there are going to be people in every faith who are not supportive. There are people in Orthodox Judaism who have a very different experience of this faith. I can't speak for every Jew, but every Jewish community event that I have been to has been about community, very much about social justice. When I go to the Missouri State Capitol, there are a lot of rabbis, a lot of yarmulkes, a lot of Jews who say, my faith tells I must fight to build a better world. I must fight for equity for every person. Jews support access to abortion, reproductive health care, gay marriage. There is so much within Judaism that talks about that social justice and community. And I think just on a personal level, when I came out, I said to my rabbi, is this okay? Is this allowed? And he did not miss a single beat in saying, absolutely. And the steps that my synagogue immediately took, making sure we had a gender-neutral bathroom, making sure all the staff were trained to support myself and the queer students who came after me, that we celebrated Pride Month, that they checked in with me to say, is everybody being okay? Do you have any concerns? I never heard the wrong name in my synagogue once I came out. They were all with it like that. That was really, really beautiful for me. And so it was also, I think, the personal experience that I had was really positive. That is so amazing as well.
That's so amazing. So different than my own experience. I don't know if you know this about me, but I grew up as a Christian pastor's kid. So you can imagine. I don't consider myself Christian anymore. But yeah, I've always had a tremendous level of respect for the Jewish faith because of many of my Jewish friends. I mean, well, there's many traditions around the world, but Judaism specifically has always, I'm not Jewish. It's just like what I've perceived, that it's been very open. And I know Judaism like prioritizes like deep questioning of things and having debates about things. And I've always respected that, kind of similar to science in a way.
Yeah, we love asking questions. If you pick up a copy of the Torah in any synagogue, it's filled with annotations of arguments between different rabbis. And one of my favorite jokes is, what do you get when you put two Jews in a room? Three opinions. We love to say, oh, but what if that is so much about exploring and asking questions, which I really love.
Yeah. And that just makes the space, especially for queer and trans people, that just makes the space so much more open and accepting. Yeah. The fact that that is kind of a culture within Judaism.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's so awesome. Well, why don't you tell us about this amazing book that you've written, My Child is Trans, Now What? Children being trans is very controversial right now in the United States and around the world. So I'm curious to hear what you have to say about your book and like how you're working through some of these social narratives that are just completely asinine when it comes to trans children.
Yeah. First, for anybody who says that a book like this is making a child trans, or that doing anything that a parent has the ability to make a child trans, Have you ever tried to make a kid clean their room? Have you ever tried to make a teenager go to bed on time? It's very hard, as it turns out, to make kids do things, identify a certain way, present a certain way. We have very little control over how our kids are going to identify. So I love to give people that reminder, which tends to, like, people don't really think about it through different lenses of, like, it would actually be very hard to make a child want to have surgery and go on hormone therapy. That's a lot. In terms of this book, which is my baby, which is so much to me, I wrote it because when I came out, the people around me, they were kind, they were safe, and that is so much, but it wasn't everything that I needed. They said, okay, you know, we don't really know what that means, but we'll all figure it out together. And so as I realized I needed different support systems, I could advocate for that and I could build it for myself. I was teaching our health classes because we didn't have inclusive curriculum. I was helping our guidance staff learn how to support trans youth in crisis because they weren't exactly sure how to support me. I was helping with our school policies, leading our student group. I was becoming all the different adults that I needed in my life because there wasn't any professional being brought in to help navigate that. There wasn't any adult who said, I know what to do, or I've looked up what to do and figured out how I want to step in. And so I've been an adult since I was 15 years old. I was jumping out of a plane with a tarp and a sewing kit, which is why as a trans adult, my career is to be the parachute factory. I always think that's really clever. I go to companies and hospitals and families and schools and build those supportive structures so that the trans and queer kids who come in after me get to be supported by default. What this book is a toolkit. It is not an instruction manual. It doesn't say, here are the 10 things to do. It says, here are the 10 questions to ask to figure out what your child wants to build. There is no expectation of here's what it means to be transgender. Here's how it might look. Here's something that might come up. But so much of it is just those resources that your child or your family member or your loved one can choose of all the things in front of me. Maybe I have no interest in cutting my hair, but I really want to talk about changing my name. Or I'm not interested in hormones, but top surgery would be really meaningful for me. You know, there's no one path. There's no end point. We're always just on a journey. All of us as humans, it's only the journey. It's only forward. So I love this book. I also want to talk for a second about the joy-centered, because that, you know, the subtitle of the book is A Joy-Centered Approach to Support. And that is everything to me. You know, trans and queer joy is so much more central than I think in the book than it is in the world around us. And I think that's a huge mistake to not focus on it more. So often, it feels like our conversations around supporting trans and queer kids begins and ends at suicide statistics, anxiety, depression. We've got a very clear picture of exactly what we're running away from. We know what we're avoiding. But when we don't know what we're moving towards, regret is a very effective boogeyman. It stops us in our tracks because we don't know what we stand to gain. My wife is a medical student, and somebody that you know says, I want to go to medical school. You don't say, but it's so expensive. There's an average $250,000 of student debt. I don't say last year, only 50% of physicians would choose to become physicians again. I say, wow, that's going to be a lot of work, but I love you. I know you can do it. We support our loved ones through decisions that they might regret when we understand what they stand to gain. So with transness and queerness, it's so important to not just know what we're running away from, but to know what we are building and what we are moving towards, to celebrate and have fun and enjoy the ride and think about our kids not as oppressed trans adults, but as trans people with lives and partners and jobs and hobbies and people who love them. They don't need to be remarkable. They don't need to be famous or authors. They can just be people with good people around them and happy lives. There are millions of trans adults with grandkids and families and just living out there doing our thing. And that's what I really want us to focus on building. And so the joy center is everything. It is saying, this is not a book about what you're losing and about problems to solve. This is a book, yes, that talks about the problems that come up, but also talks about the joy to be found and what you're gaining as a family.
Absolutely. It's a shift in perspective away from the trauma. Not that there's not that in our community, but also a shift in perspective, I think, for parents specifically. I'm not a parent yet, but I think every parent, which is just a part of that process, has expectations for their child. Like, oh, if you're assigned female at birth, you're going to marry a man and live a long, happy life with your white picket fence. And like, that's, I don't know, that's the dumb cultural narrative or expectation. I think the learning and teaching here is that that same thing can happen if parents loosen their expectations a little bit and allow their child to be themselves.
Absolutely. You know, this like grief that parents explain of like, I'm grieving my daughter. That's a grief of expectations of, yes, I know I have a daughter. And so this is everything that that means of that I'm going to walk her down the aisle and this is what her life is going to look like. Do we know for sure that we've lost those things? Do we know that there aren't other things that we're going to gain and deepening our relationship by showing up for our child or for our son now? There is so much of that grief of expectations that we go through all the time, right? Your kid comes home from freshman year of college and says, I'm going to be a theater major. There's a grief of expectations that parents have there too. Or your kid says, I want to go to trade school. College isn't the right path for me. Whatever it is that feels like not the norm, we grieve expectations often. But loosening those grasps, exactly as you said, is such a great way to really support all kids, not just trans kid. Every kid deserves to say, here's how I want to show up in the world around me.
Right. To bring some Buddhist philosophy into the conversation, non-attachment or letting go, an important part of the journey for all of us. So I want to talk more about like some of the narratives that we hear flying around all over the place about trans kids specifically, because there's some really like aggressive conversation with all of these laws being implemented, what it means for a child to be trans. And you know, some of these laws focus on like the social transition piece, like in schools, not allowing children to use chosen name or chosen pronouns. Some of this legislation focuses on so-called children receiving surgical procedures, of which is very rarely happening. So what are some of your thoughts on all of this?
Yeah. So again, I think you've already started to point out is that it is for a lot of people debating a problem that does not exist. One of the things people love to say is, you know, would you cut off a three-year-old's penis? That is never, ever not, certainly not in the context of like a gender reassignment surgery. And I hope in no context, honestly, unless there's like a medical emergency, no one is doing a gender-affirming surgery on a three-year-old, on an eight-year-old, on a 14-year-old. Before puberty, when a kid comes out, the only thing that happens is a completely reversible social transition that says, you want to cut your hair? You want to go buy a new name? You want to start wearing a dress? Cool. Great. I see you. I'm right here with you. The only thing that happens then is that kid decides who around me, sees me as me, wants to be on this journey with me. They decide whether or not they feel loved by the people around them. Social transition. When the onset of puberty comes, we can talk about puberty blockers. It's worth noting that puberty blockers are really expensive, really hard to access. And as much as people like to talk about how they're being handed out like candy and they'll put puberty blockers in anybody who says, I'm a tomboy, it's really hard. There are rigorous evaluation criteria that healthcare providers will use, specialists in gender affirming care, to decide whether or not someone is a good candidate for puberty blockers. Puberty blockers are also a pause button. They don't do anything irreversible. They just say, take a few more years to decide. And they actually became more of a suggested norm because parents were worried about putting their younger kids on hormone replacement therapy. So they said, let's hit pause for a few more years to make sure this is something that you want to do, with monitoring of your vitamin levels, making sure that everything else is safe, which is done very rigorously. It is completely safe to be on puberty blockers for most kids, but that's up to your doctor. That's something that you talk about with a professional, not with me. I'm not a doctor. And that's one of the big things I say in the book is like, I can give you a list of questions to ask and terms to know, but I am not going to give you medical advice.
Right. The other thing that I will interject here as a medical student is that like, we also have research on puberty blockers being used in a condition called precocious puberty, which is when there's an early onset puberty, like way earlier than it should occur, like 7, 8, 9, 10 years old, when normal physiologic puberty is around 11, 12, 13 years old, depending upon the person. So when things start occurring way earlier, you know, that also can disrupt human physiology and become pathological. So I think that's another important thing to mention is puberty blockers are being used for this condition specifically in that population of people. We're just applying it in a different way for trans kids. It's been studied. Exactly. So that's the only point that I want to make is that this isn't coming out of anywhere. This has been used for a long time in medicine.
The first recorded use of puberty blockers for precocious puberty was in the 50s. The first recorded use of puberty blockers for trans kids was in the 80s. This is not new.
It's not new. And the first gender-affirming surgery was performed in the 1930s by a Jewish physician, Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld. So pretty cool history.
Yeah, our history. And for anybody wondering, why haven't I heard about this? The Institute for Sexual Medicine, one of the largest centers of research around transgender people, hormone therapy, gender-affirming surgery, queerness, all that stuff, was located in Germany. And the most popular famous pictures of book burnings in Germany during World War II and the Holocaust are of the burning of the Institute for Sexual Medicine. Our history was erased on purpose. We've been here for so much longer than people think. For centuries, trans and queer people have been here. Despite people trying to erase us, they've never been able to erase us all the way, but they have certainly tried very hard.
Yes, I just mentioned that in episode 11, I told the story of Dr. Magnus Hirschfeld and the 20,000 books that the Nazis burned at the time. And now we're seeing that again with, they may not be book burnings, but they're book bans. And just hearing a lot of this rhetoric. Another thing I think about too, that I often use as kind of retort myself, because you know, we have organizations in the queer and trans community like quote unquote gays against groomers that are perpetuating the same exact narratives that were used against gay, lesbian, and bi people in the 60s, 70s, and 80s. Those same narratives have been like repackaged and are now being blasted at the trans community.
Yeah, you know, it's respectability politics at play. It's something that we see show up in most social movements that says, if you want to be accepted, we must be as close to the norm as possible. We saw it in the women's suffrage movement when white women said, we should get the right to vote, but black women, you are too different. If you attach yourselves to our movement, we'll never get it. We saw it when gay men said lesbians should not be included in the gay liberation movement. Then when gays and lesbians said, well, we're close enough to the norm, we can be normal, but bisexual people, drag queens, transgender people, absolutely not. We even see that with transgender people sometimes being what's called transmedicalists, that says you have to be a very specific type of transgender in order to get support. But non-binary people, people who use neo pronouns, you are the reason I don't have my rights. All of us pointing down the line at somebody who is smaller than us, somebody who is further away from the norm, and saying, you are the reason I don't have my rights. The gays against groomers folks are terrified that their rights are at risk, and they're pointing down the line because that is where they have power. People are terrified to look up the line and say, oh, I see who's got a boot on my neck. It's the multi-billion dollar shadow far right organization. I don't know how to respond to that. But transgender people, I can do something about. I have more power than them. It is easier for us to point down the line than it is to all link arms together and say, hey, look, it's the same people coming for all of us for the same reasons. So that respectability politics will always come back to bite us in the end.
Yes, it will. I've had the thought several times as we've been having this conversation about all of these entities that are like funding these laws against queer and trans people. You know, for those that are listening to this episode specifically, there's a phenomenal documentary on Netflix. And I don't know if you've seen this, Ben, but it's called The Family. It basically tells the story of, I think since the Reagan administration, if I remember correctly, basically tells the story how like Christian nationalists have infiltrated every level of government for years and years, like decades. And it's super scary. I mean, we may have not called them Christian nationalists at the time like we do today. It just goes to show that these organizations that were against people with uteruses, having abortions, they have been slowly working behind the scenes for five decades, for the better part of five decades, to chip away at the rights of marginalized people, especially when it comes to the abortion issue, and to chip away at queer and trans people's rights. And so I just highly recommend that everyone watch that to like have a really deep understanding of why things are happening the way they are right now.
I'm definitely going to have to look into that because it is terrifying, but keeping our heads in the sand might keep us sane, but it will not keep us safe. They've been able to get this far because nobody has noticed and has called them on it. And now we better make sure we know what's going on. We know who we're up against so that we can fight back effectively.
Absolutely. Moving in a slightly different direction, you know, share any valuable insights that, I mean, I know your whole book is full of valuable insights, but just if you could pick a couple for those that are listening that you think are super important.
Yeah, you know, there's a big one that I would love to share, which is, I think a lot about this turn of phrase we have in English of describing something as a roller coaster of emotions. And in particular, when I'm talking to parents who have a kid that's just come out, I really like that metaphor and I like to expand it a little bit because roller coasters as a concept are honestly kind of crazy. I have to imagine the first person to get on a roller coaster probably thought they were going to die. Maybe they did because how is that safe? But there is a reason that we all get on roller coasters, that we would drive hours to go to Six Flags and wait in a long line. There are a lot of reasons we feel safe going on a roller coaster. The first is because we know it was not built by Joe Schmo, who they hired fresh out of high school. It was built by a group of experts who have been studying this for decades, if not a couple hundred years. I don't know when roller coasters were invented, but they've been studying roller coasters and knowing what are the best practices for building the most safe, the most fun roller coaster. We know there is a big old restraint coming down over us that is the perfect shape and size to make sure that we don't fall out of whatever direction this cart is going to take us. And the biggest reason we feel safe getting on a roller coaster is because you look out the other side and you see a stream of people coming out, smiling, laughing, even if they threw up a little bit, they had a good time. When someone that we love comes out and is transitioning, it's so tempting to feel like I'm the first one. This has not happened in my community, in my state, in my school, in my faith, whatever it is. It can be so isolating and so easy to say, I've got to figure this out on my own. Don't try to do it alone. There are people who have spent decades building resources, not just nationally, but in your area. Look for community centers. Look for support groups. Look for the people who have just gotten off the ride and are smiling. Look for the people who are sitting right next to you. Who else is going through this right now in the same wind conditions? Who else is stuck at the top while there's a technical failure, knowing how scary that is? Not trying to do this alone is so, so important. We were not meant to be able to do anything alone as human creatures. So finding your community, finding your resources is so critical. And don't forget to have fun. There are going to be moments that are scary, and recognize that this journey isn't meant to be something that you suffer through, that you scrape by as a family. It is meant to be something that, yes, there are challenges, but it is just about authenticity. It is about your kid finding who they are and deciding you are trustworthy enough to share that with. That is beautiful. Don't forget to celebrate. Don't forget to have fun. Because at the end of the day too, especially if it is a young person coming out, this isn't just a short transgender adult. This is a kid. They should be allowed to be a kid and laugh and be silly and stubborn and creative and curious. They shouldn't have to be brave. They should get to be a kid. So finding time to play and celebrate and enjoy the ride is so important.
Yes, it is. Here's a really good question for you that popped up as you were speaking, because I know this is another one that's often discussed. What do you tell parents or just those that you're speaking to that kind of give the retort, but children are so young, how can they understand their gender identity?
Yeah, it's a good question. The first thing I say to them is, if they're too young to know that they're transgender, aren't they too young to know that they're cisgender? The only difference is that there's one identity that we want them to be and one identity that we do not want them to be. And I used air quotes for anyone listening on the podcast. I first like to ground them in that. And in general, I focus very much on a question asking approach, because if I just give them a lecture, like, they're afraid. They have a very reasonable fear. What if I'm wrong? What if it's a mistake? That's what that question is about. And that's a reasonable fear for parents to have. And so I'll spend a lot of time asking questions to help understand their fear, but I really like to walk them through what the worst case scenario is, right? Our worst case scenario is that they go through permanent changes to their body, to their gender identity and expression that then they can't undo. Our fear is that they will feel discomfort because their body doesn't reflect their gender identity. Our worst fear is that they'll experience gender dysphoria because of a transition that no longer feels right to them. And so I help them understand, you know, tell me, how is that worst case scenario different from what they are currently voicing to you, which is gender dysphoria? Our worst fear is the same as what's already happening. And to parents who say, well, can't we just make them wait a little bit longer? Statistically, it's unlikely that your kid is going to change their mind. It happens. And I talk about the statistics while also being realistic. But I tell parents, your kid is not going to spend the next year, 2 years, 5 years deciding whether or not they're trans. They're going to spend that amount of time seeing that you are not someone who is on their side. Mm-hmm. You are not someone who loves them unconditionally. They're learning what the conditions are. A lot of parents also say, I only want them to be trans if there's no other choice, because it's going to be so hard for them. I'm afraid for my kid to be trans or queer. And I say, it's going to be hard either way. The world is not easy. Are you going to be a part of making it harder or making it easier? And that's something that sometimes parents need to hear as well. They need to understand what the stakes are. Is that for us, family is the people who love us as we are, not our blood ties, not our financial dependencies. What your kid is deciding is whether they want to have you in their life the second they turn 18. They might be scheming, how can I get out of these walls? How can I find a family who loves me as me? They are not grateful to you for making them not live authentically, just to be sure. Give them space to be curious. It doesn't mean you have to say, okay, you're trans, no going back, but building that safe space to say, it's okay if you decide, actually, I do really like being a girl. I wanted to explore how it felt to be a boy, and that didn't really feel right. And knowing that you are someone who is with them on their journey, no matter what, is so meaningful.
Yes. I love what you are kind of getting at here in regards to, you know, can parents be okay with children exploring their gender identity? Even if they explore the trans side of the quote unquote spectrum, but then that doesn't work out for them and they come back to the cis side of the spectrum. I guess that's just a reflection that I think a lot of parents could find useful, is like, do I as a parent, or am I as a parent, okay with my child exploring this? Like children explore a multitude of things throughout life. And why do we have to be so attached to asking the question, why do we have to be so attached to, you know, my child was assigned female at birth, they have to behave like this? That shows more of the parents' attachments to gender identity and gender expectations and gender roles and norms and all of that stuff than it says about the child that wants to actively explore these things.
Yeah. And, you know, it also brings up this point around, it's only bad to detransition or to say, I explored that and that didn't feel right. It's only bad for families who feel that being trans is a worst case scenario. I support you because I know that if you could be any other way, you would. I think the born this way narrative does fall short, and that it creates environments where I understand that this must be awful for you, but I have to support you because I have, you know, a live daughter or a dead son, whatever it is, of that threat of misery. For some kids, it is about what brings me more joy. And I think trying to avoid thinking of being trans as a bad thing, a death sentence, a worst case scenario, makes it easier to support our kids in exploring their identities as well.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I think that points to allow children to play. That's what children are supposed to do. And if that includes gender, then so be it. I think the entire summation of this entire conversation is parents like letting go. That's a massive practice. This practice of letting go and this practice of allowing things to be different than parents may perceive them to be.
Yeah. And that benefits every kid, right?
Yes.
Let your son talk about his emotions. That doesn't make him transgender. That makes him an emotionally intelligent friend. and partner and probably a pretty cool feminist and pretty cool guy, allowing your daughter to be ambitious and to talk to her about persevering and STEM careers is going to create a powerful executive or a confident woman. There are so many reasons it benefits our kids not to box them into assumptions based on their gender identities, not just in case they're trans, but for every kid to grow up feeling like I can be whoever I want to be.
Absolutely. Well, we're going to transition now into the super soul questions.
Okay, let's do it.
So the first one is, at this moment in time, given all of your life experiences, what do you feel that your purpose is in life?
My purpose is to be the person I needed when I was younger, wherever that shows up, to be the reason somebody gets to look at me and say, oh, I didn't realize trans people could grow up and get married and write a book and have a career and a dog and a family. I want to be the reason that a parent says I can support my kid. I want to take the weight off a kid. I want to let their parent ask me 100 questions so that they can come to their kid and say, all right, I'm right here with you. I love you. I get it now. Or write policies in a workplace so a trans person can just join the company and say, wow, we've already got great policies. I can focus on doing good work. I like to do all of that because I know I'm good at it, so that other people just get to be as they are by default.
Absolutely. I love that. Knowing what you know now, what would you like to tell your younger self?
I think the biggest thing that I've gone on this journey is, first, I would tell my younger self, please ask a doctor about testosterone and what it actually does. I didn't want to go on T for a long time, and it's not because I didn't want the effects of T. It was because I didn't have any information about what it would and wouldn't do to me. To be very blunt, I assumed it would make me a bad person. The reason I didn't want to go on T is because I said, I am patient and kind and soft and silly, and if I go on testosterone, I'll lose the pieces of me that are important to me. And I assumed that that was because we talk about a testosterone-fueled rage and, oh, you know, they're just boys doing testosterone things. Spoiler alert, boys choose to be that way. Testosterone just turns up the volume on what's already there, on that socialization, on those urges and thoughts. And so it has made me aggressively nice. But I missed out on a lot of years of happiness and joy and comfort in my body because I was so afraid to lose myself, I couldn't find myself. So I'd tell myself that. And I would tell myself that, you know, the boys in the high school are not the kind of boys you want to be. Be whatever kind of man you want to be, including a feminine man. That took me a lot of years to figure out that I could be a soft, gentle, compassionate man. And that doesn't change my identity or my validity as a trans person. I can be feminine and love rom-coms and do things that people would associate with femininity. And that doesn't make me a woman. That doesn't make me less trans or less deserving of my hormone therapy or my identity or my pronouns. I could show up however I want to be. I wish I had had more time and opportunity to play at a younger age with what masculinity would look like for me.
Love that. Shout out to all the soft boys. You are valid. Yes.
Love soft boys.
Yes, me too. What is one thing that you wish others understood about the gender and sexually expansive community?
It's a good question. I think I wish they understood that this is so corny, but that we are so much more than our identities. I'm not a trans person who happens to be Ben. I'm Ben who happens to be a trans person. I don't want to make every question about my identity. I don't even necessarily want this to be my career. I'd be a librarian or a children's museum designer or a video game soundtrack score writer or whatever the word is. You know, obviously I wouldn't be very good at it, but I would try. I am so many things in addition to my transness. And so often the hate that we get is centered around boxing us into those identities. For all that people say about, oh, they just want to talk about their identities all the time, I would love for this just to be a fun fact that I could share in a circle of like, fun fact, you know, I was assigned female at birth. Ha, okay, next. Like, this isn't the most interesting thing about me. It's not the most important thing about me. We are a hugely diverse group of people. There are trans people of every race, ethnicity, religion, age, nationality. There are trans people in every hobby and music fan base and TV show fan base and whatever it is. We're everywhere. We're just human beings who show up and want to be safe and have fun with our friends and use the bathroom and eat at a restaurant. We're just like you. We're normal.
Period. What would you say to all of the lawmakers globally creating laws against us?
These laws aren't popular. People are voting handily against legislators who make anti-trans politics their platform. They are asking for their recall. They are telling them this is a waste of our resources. Your people can't afford rent. Your children are going to school 4 days a week because there aren't enough teachers. There are bigger problems to be solved that your constituents will actually be impacted by. Transgender people are not an effective scapegoat. It is not going to work for your political career. It is not going to work for your constituents. And at the end of the day, when you close your eyes and you spent a long, hard day attacking children, do you feel good about yourself? Do you feel like you did something? Do you feel better? Why are you doing that? What does that mean for you that you got to make one less kid able to go to the doctor or able to talk to their friends at school about the date that they went on last weekend? Does that really feel like the impact you want to leave on the world? Is that what you want to be remembered for?
Completely valid. I just feel like I have so much more to say about that, but we'll leave it there. What is your number one tip for queer and trans youth?
For queer and trans youth, the biggest one is don't put it all on your shoulders. Don't grow up too fast. Find the people who are in your corner. Find your champions who you can say, I need somebody to tap in. Our school doesn't have inclusive policies. Mom, can you go and bring something to the PTA meeting? There's a teacher who's not using my pronouns. Can I ask my English teacher to talk to them for me? Find the people who are in your corner who can tap in for you so that you can take time to just be a kid, have fun, and you're gonna live a whole life. I spent a long time trying to cram as much life, as much difference and achievements as possible, saying it doesn't matter if I burn out, because how long do I really have anyways? You have a life. You have so long to live and so much to give. It is not just about how much change can I do in as short of a time. You don't have to do your whole life before you turn 25. You get to do the whole life. Find people who help you build that. Slow down, take a break. You can't pour from an empty cup.
Amen. I freaking love that. Yes, 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 yes. On a more personal note, what brings you the greatest sense of connection in this world?
Yeah, I think the biggest thing is just swapping stories with people. I am very much of the belief that we have certain core stories about ourselves that are just so profoundly personal. And to share those stories, to exchange them with another human being, is the most intimate thing we can do. To sit and bear your truth for someone, to take their truth and hold it in your hands and in your heart and carry that as a piece of you, that is so beautiful. The connection I find is just in taking a moment to sit down with anybody and to hold their heart in my hands and to trust them to hold my heart in theirs. As I tell them my stories, my experiences, it is so beautiful to get to be real with people and to get to just share stories. They don't have to be the most deep, dark, personal stories, but to share the stories just that make me who I am with somebody who wants to hear them is so special.
I love that. And that's why we're doing queer story time.
Yeah.
That's fantastic. So where is Ben headed from here? What's in the future for you?
I think the biggest thing I'm working on is obviously continuing to advocate everywhere I can, workplaces, government groups, you know, doing a lot of speaking and political advocacy. The big thing that is bringing me joy and that I'm excited about is a fantasy novel that I'm writing, very different from my first parenting book, that is just about the magic that trans people have from our identities, our experiences, the things that we learn. I'm so excited to be putting that together. Who knows when it'll see the world, but at least for right now, for me, it's a source of joy that I get to take a little work day and go into this trans utopia of people running away from their kingdom to take care of each other. So putting out more stories into the world, more positivity, continuing to be your trans older brother on social media and just finding new ways. I'll go wherever I can be, where I can be doing the most good.
That's amazing. And where can people find you if they want to get in touch?
Yeah. The best way is through my website, which is bgtranstalks.com. My email is the same, bgtranstalks@gmail.com. You can also find me on Instagram at pseudo.bro, pseudo.bro, because I'm your fake older brother, and on TikTok as pseudobro without the period. Thanks, testosterone. Some medical humor for you if you're still listening to this part. Nobody ever finds that as funny as I do, but I think it's hilarious.
I think it's hilarious. I saw that and I was like, Well, thank you, Ben, for being a part of Queer Story Time. It's been an honor to have you here and to have you show up as your authentic self for everything that you are and all your soft boy pseudo bro realness.
Thank you so much for having me. This has been so much fun.
I love it. So everyone listening, stay tuned for episode 14 of Queer Story Time coming up at the beginning of August, featuring QST's first lesbian couple. We'll see you then.
Hey friends, I'm so delighted that you've made it this far. I sincerely hope that this episode has opened your heart and provided you with valuable insights into the lived experiences of those in gender and sexually expansive communities. There are several ways in which you can support this podcast. Make sure that you're subscribed if you haven't already done so, and be sure to share it with friends and family. Queer Storytime is a professionally produced podcast, which costs about $80 per episode. If you feel called to do so, I kindly ask that you support future episodes of this podcast by making a one-time or ongoing contribution that is sustainable to you. Links to contact me or to contribute to this podcast are found within the description of this episode. From the bottom of my queer heart to yours, I'm sincerely grateful for you tuning in to Queer Story Time, the podcast. Hugs and love, y'all. Until next time.